podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Jones! Bowden!
He's got it! England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins!
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match!
Hello, welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket. And of course, the question is, can Ben Stokes lead England to those glories, Simon, that you commentated so expansively and so excitedly on from 2019 as the new England Test captain? So we'll discuss that, Simon Hughes and Simon Mann with you here. And also in this show, later on, we have this guest.
I never want to be a cricketer, I want to be a boxer. And my dad took me to the Oval in 76, put me on the edge of the rope. I never watched cricket before until 76. I saw this tall, elegant man walking towards me. I thought he was coming down to field. He turned around and bowled. It was Michael Holden. And I was lucky enough. I'm sure he took eight that day. I was in the car. I said, Dad, I want to be a fast bowler. I said, Dad, I don't want to box. I'm no good at it. Please let me be a fast bowler. And I just remember trying to mimic what he did. I used to get my mates to get a bat in the playground on concrete, and we used to wet the ball so it used to skid off a bit quicker. And that's where I learned to bowl quick, is in the playground. And a lot of my mates thought, yeah, well, we're bat against you. And I used to, you know, to wet the ball and skid off and hit them. It's only a tennis ball, but when it got wet, it used to sting. Then I went down to my local cricket club, Gloucester City. Coach again said, what do you do? I said, I bowl fast. He said, what else do you do? I said, don't do anything else, I bowl fast. And I didn't have a clue about what cricket was. I just said, I bowl fast. So he said, okay, here's the ball. I took I took my run up and I tried to go as far back as possible. And I ran in and I remember bowling this delivery and I skidded because I didn't have a grip on my skin. And I ended up flying down halfway down the wicket. And I remember the coach, his name was Brian Warrell, said that was the quickest delivery he's ever seen from a young kid of 13.
Who's that then? Well, of course, we build that in Twitter, actually, that it's David Lawrence, Sid Lawrence, Gloucestershire's first ever black president. And he was a guest in the Virtual Cricket Club the other night. And so we'll hear plenty from him about his plans and actually his origins in getting into the game as well later in the show. But we should, Simon, first talk about the inevitable appointment of Ben Stokes as captain. Everybody thought it would happen. Rob Key did the sensible thing. Is that how you look at it?
Well, we talked about this last week, didn't we, Oz? We said, you know, do the logical, straightforward thing. Ben Stokes has been vice-captain of the England cricket team for a while. He captained England in one-day cricket last summer. If not Ben Stokes, then who? And also, why was Ben Stokes vice-captain if you're not going to then turn to him as the next England captain? The reservations, of course, are based on what happened to Ian Botham, who had a lot on his plate as an all-rounder, England's talisman, Andrew Flintoff, same story. But just because they're all-rounders doesn't mean to say they're the same type of person. So also, Ben Stokes is 30. What did Ian Botham get the job at? Probably
much younger.
Early mid-20s, something like, you know, about 24, 25, from memory, off the top of my head. Yeah. Yeah. And also, as well, he was up against the West Indies team. You know, he had a really tough baptism, and it didn't go particularly well, of course.
It didn't go particularly well. I mean, of course, Botham's record as captain was played 10-1-0.
Yeah. And who knows, Ben Stokes' record as captain might be the same. I mean, he's actually played one and lost one so far. I mean, I was there. You talk about actually Ian Botham playing against the West Indies. Of course, Ben Stokes' only test match so far in charge has been against the West Indies, down in Southampton, the first match after lockdown. And England lost the game against, you know, a West Indies side that were not that good, let's face it. Especially in English conditions, England went on to win the series, but he did that match in Southampton. It was a great game of cricket, actually, a really fascinating game, but West Indies managed to win. But, I mean, you know, it's a very small sample size to go on. So, yeah, England have done the logical thing, really, almost the only thing, and well, not quite the only thing, they could have gone elsewhere, but that would have been a bit left field, I think, to have gone elsewhere. So, yeah, and the point we made last week, you know, imagine saying, no, Ben, we're not going to go to you. You've been the vice captain. You are the talisman on the side. You know, you did captain last summer in one-day cricket and win 3-0 against Pakistan. We're going to go somewhere else. We're going to pluck out Charles Smith from Northumberland to do the job. It would have just been really weird, wouldn't it? I think it doesn't guarantee anything, but I think it's the for now it's the logical choice.
Yeah, and I think he is a captain bursting to come out of that body, and because you just look at him, he wants to contribute to the whole strategy all the time. Watching him in the field, you can see his mind is working. And he's pointing at things and talking to players. And, you know, he's a very engaged character. And there's sometimes someone like an Ian Botham character was very engaged when he was actually bowling or batting, but probably quite detached, actually, when he wasn't. You know, when he was sort of in the dressing room or something, he would have been sleeping or talking to a friend or reading a paper or whatever. But Stokes is someone who's just constantly engaged. He's energised by the game. He's desperate to improve. He's desperate for England to improve. Looking at his, you know, people have said to me, will it affect his game? Will it affect his contribution? I think if anything, it could inspire his contribution, actually. His batting average has declined slightly from a high of 38 in 2020 to a 35.7 or something now. So disappointing, actually, his performances with the bat. But then, of course, he was out of the game, test match game, for a while last year. It took a little bit of time to get back into it in the Ashes. He's still got a better batting average than bowling average, which, you know, in your kind of description or evaluation of all-rounders is important, that the batting average is higher than the bowling average. Not a great bowling average, 32. I mean, I think one of the things that is going to challenge him is how much he uses his bowling as captain. Because sometimes in the middle of bowling spells, you can't get hold of the ball, you can't get the ball off him. And, you know, he's going to have to kind of regulate his contributions with the ball because of his injury track record as much as anything. So that will be one of the challenges, I think. But actually, where he bats, four or five, is a perfect place for a batsman. I think it's tough. If you're the opening batsman or the number three and captain, that really is tough because you just get no breathing space. You're getting the pads on as soon as you got off the field. Four or five just gives you that little bit of a break, hopefully, although perhaps not in England's case, before you have to actually get out there again. So I think, you know, in many ways, it's a perfect time for Stokes, now in his early 30s, to take the reins.
Do you see any prospect? You mentioned, you know, top order is tough because, you know, especially if you've been bowling, or bowling some overs anyway, and then you're right out there again if you're strapping the pads on if you're batting the top order. Do you think there's any logical argument for him going back to number six again, so, you know, to fill that sort of real middle order role?
Possibly. I suppose the only thing I'd say about that is that he takes his time to get into an innings now, whereas in the past he could kind of get going quite quickly. I think he prefers now to really get stuck in defensively for a while. And so a number five spot might be enable him to do that. Whereas number six, sometimes you're a game changer sort of position there.
But he is a game changer, isn't he?
I mean, he is a game changer.
Well, here's the question: what is his role in this England side? Could it be a slightly different one? Is it as a game changer? But whereas I agree with you, recently he's become far more of a batting all rounder, hasn't he? Or, you know, he's become more of a batsman in a sense. You know, the responsibility there, and he's taken that responsibility on by taking his time to get in. We have seen him, but I think at six you can still give yourself a bit of time and then you can go, because the role is slightly different. Anyway, it's just a thought I had, whether he might drop down to number six because of the demands on him, possibly. And actually, you know, it might be that he's a bit more effective at six, and actually you can, what that does is put a bit more responsibility on some of the batters further up the order. So, come on, right, this is, you know, this is our captain, he's our sort of talisman, he's in the middle order, you show your own responsibility and Dan will get some runs in that sort of top order. But he's good enough to bat five, he's possibly good enough to bat higher than five, isn't he? That's the thing. So what do England do with him? Is it asking a bit too much to say bat five, captain the side and bowl, you know, X number of overs as England's fourth seamer?
I like your suggestion. You know, number six, it's a good pivotal position, as long as you've got decent batsmen behind you.
Well, yeah.
So a decent wicketkeeper and, you know, a couple of reasonable all-rounders. But I don't know. I think he could be wasted at six. Mm. You look at some of the really significant innings he's played, they have taken quite a long time. I'd just prefer to give him that time. So I think five.
Fair enough. Okay. Well, it was just a thought that whether, you know, six might be the option if he is the captain. But it, you know, clearly he is good enough to bat, you know, higher than six. I mean, there have been some suggestions he could bat a number three for England. I don't see that happening. Certainly not as captain anyway. No. And we've got Joe Root's up there at number three now anyway. And that's, you know, well, I presume that's locked in.
I suppose it's up for discussion. Mm. More interestingly, I think one of the first things that Stokes stroke Rob Key will do is bring back Anderson and Broad. It sounds like they've already been very carefully and encouragingly spoken to. I see Anderson 3 for 24 yesterday, knocked over James Vince early on in the Lancashire-Hampshire game. Stuart Broad less successful, 1 for 60, I think, or 1 for 40 or something off his 8 overs. But I'm sure he'll get into a gallop pretty soon. And Rob Key's intention to pick the best team is also very sensible.
Yeah. I had that sort of hunch about the West Indies. I was ambivalent about Anderson Broad being left out. You know, I could see what they were trying to do in the Caribbean. But also, there was that feeling, wasn't it? Are England good enough to say, oh, we're going to, you know, just look at the future? You know, it has to be try to win every test match in front of you, don't you? I think that's what they've lost a little bit. And, well, clearly that's an understatement. That's the way they're going to go this summer, isn't it? And that's got to be the right thing. You know, the most important game is the next one, and take it from there and see what works out from there.
Yeah, it's easy to say that, but, you know, succession planning is also important. And in a way, it's difficult for selectors because, particularly in Anderson's case, he keeps defying humanity, longevity, by constantly performing when most logic would say this guy's got to be in decline, but he's not. He still maintains his incredible fitness levels and penetrative bowling and bowling
speeds.
So
what's wrong with that then? Why not?
Well, nothing's wrong with it. But what I'm saying is that in the past, you would assume that someone in their late 30s was in decline. But neither Broad or Anderson seem to be. Mm. And so they keep kind of almost confounding the selectors who are trying to kind of plan for succession. But maybe they don't need to, because these guys just keep going.
I know what you mean. You know, eventually they're going to fall in a heap, aren't they? And you're suddenly going to need two bowlers to take their places. And that's sort of what they tried in the West Indies. And Saqib Mahmood had he showed promise, didn't he, in that test match. Matt Fisher got a wicket early on. Of course, he's now out for a month with a back injury. But I just wonder at the moment, where England are at the moment is just win the next test match. The most important game is that first one against New Zealand at Lord's, and then move on from there. I saw Rob Key say yesterday, you know, it doesn't mean to say they're going to come back into the frame, but it doesn't mean to say they're going to play the next game or all summer. We'll take it on a game by game basis. And the nature of that series actually against New Zealand suggests that they're going to have to rotate a little bit anyway, because they basically got four pretty close test matches, haven't they? We've got the three against New Zealand in June, and then straight away in July, one against India. So it's quite an intense schedule anyway. So it's inevitable that you're going to need a pool of fast bowlers. And that's sort of the way they go now anyway, isn't it, really? It's very hard for you to play all the games. I mean, that's one of the issues that Australia are going to have down the line with Pat Cummins, I suppose, is, you know, can he play every single game? And you probably have to try to piece together the schedule accordingly. And I mean, Cummins actually is an interesting sort of test case, isn't it, for someone who, you know, like Stokes, who, I mean, Cummins is right at that heart of that Australian side, bowling his overs. I supposedly, you know, should be quite useful as a batter down the order. Of course, he's not as high or as good as Ben Stokes as a batter. But also, he is someone who sort of really does feel like the focal point of that Australian side as well. And, you know, similarly with Stokes, and I think it's worked quite well for Australia so far with Cummins. Early days, of course, but I mean, a win over England, emphatic win over England, win in Pakistan, not bad for starters.
Another key appointment, no pun intended, will be the coach, the next test coach. Gary Kirsten is rumoured. And in a way, the coach is important, of course, not just for setting strategy and all the detail, but also taking the pressure off the captain and doing all the kind of things that captains sometimes find themselves doing. Gary Kirsten, I think, would be very good for a couple of reasons. I mean, firstly, his experience working with the likes of India and so on, and working at test match level for other countries. And I think also the fact that he's a dogged batsman, you know, he never gave his wicket away. He understands the art and importance of concentration and building a platform and establishing a position. And I think he will be very strong in getting England's structure, their batting structure, really organised so that they do create that platform for the bowlers.
Do you know it's going to be Gary Kirsten, or are you just saying that's one of the names that's been put forward?
And I think he would be a good choice. And, well, Rob Key listens to this podcast, so maybe we can influence him. I think Gary Kirsten's got a lot of integrity. He's been around the traps. You know, he's worked at various countries. He's done lots of different jobs. He's a specialist batting coach as well, runs his own academy in Western Province. And he's just a fantastic man who loves the game, sees the sort of bigger picture, and he's a very easy person to work with, talk to. He's intelligent, he's responsive, quote, open-minded, but I think also quite strong and clear in his vision.
Yeah, well, I thought Gary Kirsten should have got it last time, to be honest, ahead of Chris Silverwood, but they didn't go down that route. Gary Kirsten's... I think that one of the issues was that Chris Silverwood's presentation at the interview was really impressive, whereas Gary Kirsten, I think, used the strategy that he did when he went to India, because when he went to be the India coach, he sort of went there and he said, right, ask me whatever you want, rather than give a presentation. You've invited me here. Clearly, you see something in me. And my understanding is he did. You know, he went use that approach again. Whereas Chris Silver did a really detailed and impressive presentation. There we go. Anyway, so
he Gary sounds Kirsten like me when I go into those meetings. I mean, I just think some of this stuff is just a load of BS, really. And you've got to delivery is what it's all about. Execution, well, rather than talking a game.
Yeah, I mean, you have got to have a strategy, though, haven't you? You've got to get your vision across, I suppose. You know, I mean, there are different ways. Listen, there are different ways of doing it, aren't there? And I suppose the skill is in the people who are doing the interviews, actually, to try to understand what it is the person in front of you is trying to get across and why they've approached it in that particular way, and have that imagination, perhaps left field thinking, to say, okay, this person can offer us this. He's got this sort of experience. This person can offer us this. Perhaps he doesn't have as much experience, or she doesn't have as much experience. So yeah, it's not just about the person being interviewed. It's also about the skill of the interviewees as well, and your HR process.
And maybe in that sense, someone like Simon Katic, who's been mentioned as the possible white ball coach, has an advantage because he's worked with Rob Key on commentary in the Australia-Pakistan series recently. And you get a good sense of someone when you're, especially on live commentary, as you know, you get a good sense of someone's personality, their observations, their views, you know, their kind of attitudes, when you work with someone quite closely like that, and on commentary and sort of analysing players and so on. And Katic, I mean, you've worked with him a bit as well. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I worked with him on the last... but one Ashes tour over in Australia. He was working for ABC, was part of their commentary team. Like, nice, gentle sense of humour, sort of quiet, thoughtful commentator. I really liked him. I found him, you know, very easy to work with. I mean, I don't know what he's like sort of in the dressing room and out on the cricket field, but he seemed like quite a sort of unassuming, quite a gentle sort of man. Anyway, that's only my impression, and I worked with him again for BT a bit in the winter as well, and just similar, you know, thoughtful man, you know, a good analyst of the game.
Yeah, and he's done his jobs in short format cricket, working in the IPL and the Big Bash and so on. So yeah, again, lots of experience. I think it's really good to have worldly experience, to have worked with overseas teams when you come into the England job.
Just something worthy of note with Simon Katic. He was actually supposed to be working in the IPL with the Sunrisers Hyderabad as their assistant coach, and he resigned from his position back in February. And there was a lot of talk about, you know, the reason behind this. One of the reasons given was that he wanted to avoid a long period in the IPL, you know, bio bubble. But there were also reports behind the scenes that he wasn't happy with Sunrisers' strategy at the auction, and he wasn't happy with the way they went. So anyway, that's something that can be, if he does become the England one day coach or white ball coach, perhaps can be teased out sometime in the future, you know, the real reasons for it. But I mean, that actually shows, doesn't it, a sort of quite a strong mind, if that's the case. You know, I'm not happy with the way we went. I'm not sure how the season's going to pan out. As it's turned out, actually, Sunrisers, I watched one of their early games. They looked absolutely dreadful. They looked as if they were just going to fall in a heap again, as they did last year. But suddenly they've really picked up, although they were downed by that amazing conclusion the other day when Rashid Khan hit 6 after 6 in the final over and won the game for Gujarat. So anyway, that's just a little side issue with Simon Cattish. One other name that's been mentioned, I mean, lots of names have been mentioned, of course they have, is Graham Ford as a potential test match coach. And that's someone Rob Key has worked with at Kent. He's the former Sri Lanka coach. He's the former Ireland coach. And he's also worked very closely with Kevin Peterson, didn't he, on his batting. So Graham Ford is another name that's been mentioned. I don't know whether that is because that people have put two and two together, you know, the past link between Rob Key and Graham Ford. You don't just want to employ all the people you know, sort of
jobs
in the game,
for the boys.
Do you? you don't want that, and I'm sure that won't happen. I think one thing, you know, we can say about Rob Key, this is the best moment of his job in a way at the moment, or the most straightforward in a way.
You haven't played a game.
Well, you haven't played a game, and you've appointed the captain, who's the obvious choice, and now you've got things like, you know, who are the two coaches going to be, who's going to be the selector. It looks actually as though that's going to be delayed for a while, and just reading some of Rob's comments yesterday, seems like he's quite keen to be involved in the selection of the squad stroke team himself for that first test match. I suppose you could sort of understand it. It's Alex Stewart's point, really, and you know, ended up Chris Silverwood taking complete control of selection. You know, if your head is on the chopping block, you really actually want to have the players that you want. Do you know what I mean? It happens in football, doesn't it? You select the team because you're the one who's responsible for the results. Well, that's the way it's seen anyway. Whereas sometimes the coach is sort of, can be not sidelined, because the captain often gets the team they want, or the selectors, you know, give you the squad. I mean, generally speaking, captain coach roughly get what they want anyway, don't they?
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure Ben Stokes is going to get what he wants. I mean, that's going to be quite an interesting conversation when it comes to the final 11, Stokes versus Key versus whoever's the coach. And I'm pretty sure Stokes will get his way. And actually, Key will understand that and give him his due as well, especially first test.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's the way it often happens. I mean, Michael Vaughan, I think he said when he was England captain, I think he pretty much got every team that he wanted, you know, for every game. And so there is that conversation in the round between those who sort of have, you know, put their two penneth worth in there, the coach, the captain, the selector, the head selector, whoever that is. Because I suppose there is, I know everyone can see all the streams these days, but there is a, you know, there is a value in having a national selector goes round and sees the new players.
Absolutely.
Not least the Lions players, who are the emerging players.
No, absolutely, you need that. And Dustin Miller, who was in our virtual cricket club a few weeks ago, absolutely said that. And the reason really is that it's not just about seeing their ability in black and white or multicolour. It's about talking to other players, colleagues, opponents, coaches, managing directors, whoever, who've worked with these players, and talking to the player themselves, actually, about their approach and their preparation and their ambition and so on. And just getting a sense of what they're about, because, you know, especially test match cricket is so much about character as much as it is about ability. And you can't really establish character by watching a stream with two cameras, one each end.
No, and just going back in the day, and this is an old story, isn't it? I mean, Tony Greig, remember when he was trying to find players to take on the West Indies in Australia in the mid-70s? He went round and he speak to umpires? And he said,
yes.
Which batters out there are, you know, have got the character, have got the grit to stand up to the Australia and the West Indies. And the name that came up was David Steele at Northamptonshire, who's into his 30s, and he had those sort of two golden summers. And yeah, in a way, justified what the experienced cricket watchers out there saw with their own eyes.
And prompted, of course, Geoff Thompson's famous comment when Steele emerged, "Who have we got here, Father Christmas?"
Yeah.
He did his bit, though. Steely, didn't he? Stainless, as they called him. And let's hope Stokes and Key and their alliance together brings greater prosperity to England. And you can't really ask for two more kind of dedicated or decent men, actually, ultimately, to do that job.
Yeah, I've said it before, you don't expect too much too soon. There is talent out there in the English game, but it might well take a while to harness, and there might be a few blips on the way. There's another Ashes series next summer, isn't there? I mean, we forget that. It's easy to forget that. We don't want to look too far ahead, but it's not too far away. And then that, of course, is always a benchmark for an English team, is an Ashes series. And it's not actually that far away. It's only just over a year away before Australia come to try to win in England for the first time since 2001. A lot is made of the fact that England hardly ever win in Australia, or get thumped most of the time in Australia. Australia haven't won here since 2001, although the series tend to be a bit far more competitive than the ones that are played in Australia.
Now, a different challenge presents our main guest today, who was in our virtual cricket club the other night, as the new president of Gloucestershire, the first black president of Gloucestershire. It's the man who was always known in the game as Hissing Sid, and he was hissing. When you faced him, it was just this huge, muscle-bound figure charging towards you like a rhino, hissing and breathing fury, hurling the ball down as fast as he could. And it was a pretty terrifying sight if you're at the other end, and I was, and I absolutely hated it. But what a wonderful man, David Lawrence, as of course he's officially known. And he was the guest in our virtual cricket club, and he was appointed very recently as Gloucestershire's first black president. And so the first thing he talked about was his plans for Gloucestershire.
And the point he made, yours, that it's not just an honorary position. He wants to make a real difference.
There's a lot of people who think it's a bit of a tick-in-the-box exercise because what has happened in cricket over the last 6 months, my documentary with Sky, the saga Yorkshire, the landscape of cricket had to change. Now, okay, me being the first black president for Gloucestershire, It first of all, it was a great honour for them to ask me, and I'm so proud to take the role, but I'm not going to be a guy who just sits around and does nothing. The club know already I've got big plans, not big plans, but things just to make them a bit more current. It's not just a cricket side, a cricket club. I want this to be more current in what's going on and be a bit more part of the community. I've gone to them with my ideas and they're all for it. I've got a great story to tell about my cricket career, how I started, how I was derailed, how I kind of, you know, was disorganized and, you know, thought, you know, got signed by Gloucester, thought I was a bit of a Jack the Lad, being out all nights, being arrested, sitting in police cells, being bailed, certain people coming into my life at the right time, which I'm sure you know the story about Viv Richards.
Well, I don't. Tell us.
Yeah. The story is, you know, Tony Brown at the time, I got myself in a bit of bother. I was 17, 16, moved to Bristol, got involved in a couple of scraps, got arrested in the cells, had to phone Tony. It was a funny story. At the beginning of the season, Tony Brown said to the boys in a pre-season kind of meeting, "I don't care what time of day, it was all night, give me a ring if you got a problem." Well, I got arrested. I was 16 in the cells. They said, "You could have one phone call." It was 3 o'clock in the morning. I said, "Tony, do you remember you said that I could ring you anytime?" He wasn't that happy, I must have been. He got me a solicitor and he said, "I want you at the county ground." Now, you remember, I was only, like I said, 16, 17. I went to the county ground, 9 o'clock sharp. So I got to the county ground. He sat me in his car, didn't have a clue where we were going. We were just driving down the motorway. We drove into another cricket ground. He sat me on a stool. He said, "You sit there." And Tony Brown was quite, he had those piercing blue eyes. He was quite a scary character when he wanted to be. And from a distance, I saw this fella walking towards me in a red tracksuit. I remember it was a bright red tracksuit with this swagger. And it was Viv Richards coming towards me. I was at Taunton. And he arranged Viv Richards to have this chat with me, to sit me down. He sat next to me, and I was, you're talking, he was my hero. And he's sitting next to me, and I'm just looking at him. I didn't know what, you're just completely starstruck. And he just gave me this, it was the most fantastic kind of mentor kind of chat about you. Sometimes in life, you only get one chance, and you've got to grab it with, and you've got to be twice as good, but don't miss out on this opportunity that you've been given. So he's giving me this pet talk, 14 years when I was 16. And then 15 years later, I'm at the top of my run, bowling to Viv Richards in his last test match, and I get him out in his last test match. What about that for a story? You know, and I'm the guy who gets him out in his last test match, and he's the guy really who put me on the right track. I'm starting my career, and at the end of his career, I'm bowling to him, and I'm the last man to get him out in his last test match. Incredible, you know, but so for me, that was something what really changed me and put me on a straight and narrow. So 82, that was.
Yeah.
So I was 16, 17. I was a young lad, but took time out of his day. Tony Brown organized it. And I always had to thank Tony for that, because the club thought, nah, get rid of this kid. He's just going to be more trouble than he's worth. We don't care what talent he has. Get rid of him. And Tony Brown said, no, this guy's got something. I want to stick with him. And he stuck his neck out for him. And I said, I'll never let him down. I didn't. Yeah, so those are stories that I want to be able to tell youngsters, tell them of my story, my journey. And it's a great story. I've got some great things I can tell them. Hopefully I can inspire one of them. So that's one of the projects. I'm going to go out to the schools, to the inner city schools, you know, and tell my story.
Within that story, I mean, what do you, obviously that's a brilliant start. So what did cricket do for you, and how did that help you, and what did it give you in the end?
Well, it gave me a lot of discipline. Don't get me wrong. As that documentary showed on Sky, I had a lot of downtime where I was subjected to racial abuse by, you know, not just on the field. When I went to Yorkshire, I had an incident with my own teammates. So there were some really low moments. And I think you have to be very strong, strong-minded, strong-willed. I remember sitting in my hotel room and thinking, what makes me different to everybody else? Why have I got to suffer this racial abuse or my own teammate? Back then, as you know, Jos, there was nowhere to turn. You couldn't turn anywhere. My club didn't even investigate the matter. And I hope that if somebody hears my story and they're having difficulties to progress that pathway to success, and they feel it's being hindered because of their color, because of their gender, because of their religion, then hopefully listening to my story, that hopefully that can inspire them to speak out.
Obviously, we're all horrified to hear of what you experienced. And I got a bit of a wind of it, I suppose, earlier on, a few 20 years ago, I remember hearing some whispers about this, and it was horrible to hear. Do you think actually that being a fast bowler, some of your experiences sort of almost motivated you to try even harder, kind of thing?
Oh, I mean, people say that to me, and I said no. But the only motivation, and the people I give credit to, is my parents. They're the ones who motivated me and told me, if you want to succeed, you've got to be twice as good. You can't be average. You can't be equal. You've got to be twice as good. And that always stuck in my mind. When I turned up at county trials, I was the only kid from state school. All the kids were from private school. You're talking back in the 70s now. You know, my school didn't play cricket, but I was put forward to go to the school's cricket trials. And I remember turning up in a, I just had a Tesco's bag, and my whites was in there with, I didn't have proper cricket boots, I had plimsolls. But I was so quick that the coaches, they could not pick me. I was just twice as fat as all the other kids. They had no choice. You know, if I was equal, I don't think I would have gotten, because I didn't fit their criteria. I wasn't from the right school, but they had no choice.
The player said that racially abused you at Gloucestershire. Have you spoken to him since? Has there been a rapprochement?
Yeah, since the documentary came out, I did get a phone call and we sat down and had lunch. You got to remember, I played with that person for, for a good, all of my career, basically. Yeah, it was a tough sit down. It was emotional for both of us. And when I did that documentary, I don't know if you saw it, but I was very tearful because it really did bring up a lot of things I buried. Yeah, so it was hard to talk about, but he rang me, we sat down, and so long as he has learnt and it's educated him to be a better person, then I'm happy to sit down and move on.
Just picking up on your aims as the new chairman, what sort of things do you want to do? You said you talked to the club about, some of your ideas. Do you want to just give us
we have a carnival, St. Paul's Carnival is very similar to the Nottingham Festival on Carnival. We've never celebrated as a club and it's just a mile down the road. So it's things like that I want to be able to celebrate within the club. We have a gay pride in Bristol. I've said I want to fly a rainbow flag next to the Gloucestershire flag when it's gay pride in Bristol. And they are totally up for that. Those are the things this season I want to achieve. I'm going to get a food bank in the club. Every county should have a food bank that members can drop off food. It can be collected once a month and distributed around the community. That should be standard for every single county club. And for me, it amazes me that nobody's done it yet. Mm. I'm just, and that is what I talk about, current things. That's current. And clubs, I think, just need to catch up and be a bit more current in what they do.
I guess because you're very much kind of Gloucestershire born and bred, you are very much part of the community and you've kind of got another life, which is, running a nightclub and all that. So I suppose that helps you stay young in a way, does it?
Yeah. And I can, I can see, the youngsters, what they've got to deal with day to day. It's not everybody what I come across have got life rosy. Some of them have got it tough. I'm able to communicate with them. They're able to share their stories with me. And yeah, I'm talking about inner city kids. It's going to be black, white, it doesn't matter. I just hopefully my role make me more visible in the community.
You must be the first county chairman in history who runs a nightclub, surely.
Yeah, I think they're all ex-school teachers, so I'm probably the first, definitely. So that's going to be a one-off.
Are you surprised to suddenly have this role, Sid? I mean, you're in your late 50s now. I mean, you've been sort of a long time away from the club, really.
My age there, thank you very much, Simon. Look, if you have asked me, well, I've got this role only 2-3 years ago, probably not. Would it I have fit the criteria to have the job? Probably not. Like I said, the landscape of everything has changed. I think cricket's got to catch up with more diversity. And I think, yes, I had to think about taking the role. Obviously, I didn't just jump on it. It took me 3 months to sit down with my family, my son, my wife, and discuss it. Are they offering you for the right reason? Is it a PR exercise? Which, admittedly, a lot of clubs at the moment could quite easily do. It's just a PR exercise because cricket's under the microscope. Let's do this PR exercise. Let's get everybody off us and say, we're doing this, we're doing that. And if it is, at the end of the day, you have to start somewhere. If you keep turning down these roles were offered to you, then where do we start? We can't just say, well, we're not being offered the roles. Whether you think it's for the right reasons or wrong reasons, you've got to start from somewhere. And like I said, if you ask me, well, I've got this, would that have been possible 3-4 years ago? No, I don't think so, because I think most people's mindset would have been still back in that old kind of traditional way of thinking with cricket.
Just to pick up on one other thing, you want to do this sort of engage the younger generation and the inner city communities and so on. What do you say to them about cricket? Why is cricket important? Why is Gloucestershire important to you and for them?
Sport in general is one thing. It's like an extended family. Once you get involved with sport, I think it's a great way for discipline, turning up for on time for training, all these things. And I think it's just a for me, it was a great discipline. And you meet a lot of people and you mix in different circles. For me, I think it's so important that, you know, people get involved in sport because it's something I think is missing. I think there's a lack of youth, what are called youth clubs. Well, you know, on our day, they were called youth clubs. And they're no longer around. Kids used to finish school, go to a youth club, engage in table tennis, all these kinds. These places are all closed down. There's none around anymore. And it's trying to engage the kids and getting involved in different sports. And, you know, I still think that a lot of kids still don't see cricket as a career. I think they all see football as this career, but they don't understand that cricket can be a career as well. And you can earn, you know, you don't want to just play it for the money, but you can earn decent money and you can have it as a career. So I think if you can get that across them as well. But again, it's just not about that. So I think the participation of youngsters, black, Asian, white, playing cricket is quite high. But there seems to be a lack of that pathway for them to succeed and go into county cricket. It seems to stop somewhere. And that, you know, and we need to know, why does it stop when they're 15, 16? Why is that? Why do they fall out? Is it because they're being not encouraged by their coach? There has to be a reason why. You know, Yossi, when we were playing, you know, Haringey College was producing so many cricketers.
Yeah.
And what did the ECB do? Cut the funding. I mean, you know, and you've got to ask why. Why would you cut the funding of a project what is succeeding and doing really well, you know, and it's producing cricketers from the community? You might be in a better position to answer that than me. I have no idea.
Are you involved with Ebony's ACE program, Ebony Ray's ACE program?
Yeah, I'm going to get involved. I've spoken to a club. We had a meeting today. What I don't want to do is start stepping on people's toes. I mean, they're doing a fantastic job. Anything I can do to help and higher the profile, then I'm willing to do. They can get on with the coaching and that side. If I can help to higher the profile, then I'm all willing to do that. So I think they're doing a great job. The funding's there and hopefully the funding continues. And they see these projects. That is my biggest thing. They see these projects through. I love cricket and I love what's going on, but we've got to see these things through. And for me, I'm passionate about not just changing things on the field. I want to see change in the workplace. I want to see change in schools. I want to see change with headmasters of colour. So we have to, you know, when I walk through Gloucestershire, they talk about in the field, but when I walk through, I don't see much change in the offices. I don't see much change, you know. I don't, the ECB, they talk about change. I don't see much change when I look through their employer's book from last year, the PCA. I don't see much change there. So we've got to just say it's change on the field and we've got to get people thinking different. I think overall, we got to change. Everybody should look at themselves. Every industry needs to change.
What sort of conversations have you had with Will Brown, who's the chief executive at Gloucestershire?
Will is very supportive. David Jones, the chair, he's very supportive. And they just say, look, you know, just get on and do what you feel you need to do. First of all, I'm honoured to have this position. And if I can just do something in those 2 years that makes a slight change and leave some form of what I've done and people can carry on the baton and not just say, okay, that's what's it done, that's finished. I want it to continue when I finish my 2 years tenure.
Are you going to be down there on match day every day?
Yeah, and not every day. I mean, you know, but I don't want to be that president who goes every day and it's a chance to invite your mates, sit upstairs with your blazer on, have a few gin and tonics. That's not really going to be me, you know. I'll be down there certain days, yes, but I'm not down there to entertain. I'm down there to watch the cricket maybe. And off the field, I want to, like I said, the role for me is to do as much as I can do off the field. Not for people just say, oh, I saw Sid today. Great. But that's not what I see my role as.
fantastic man, isn't he, Sid? And, you know, he just breathes enthusiasm and energy, not least in the fact that his other job is running a nightclub which starts at midnight and finishes at 6 in the morning, Fridays and Saturday nights. I think he must be the first.
Why don't they start them why don't they start them at 6 in the evening and finish at midnight?
See, you haven't got that many teenagers in your house yet, have you? Well, you've got one, but...
I have, I've got two.
Well, wait. Until they get to about 18 or 19, and then...
They are. One of them is 19, yeah, and you're right. She says about 11 o'clock at night, I'm going out now, I'm going out to the club, yeah.
You know, they basically don't see much daylight, those kind of age groups, except the daylight at 7 in the morning when they're coming home. But, you know, there's something about Sid I really love, except obviously facing his bowling. And, you know, his story actually about how he got into the game in that slightly... intangible way where, you know, he was a boxer, and actually he got interested by his dad taking him to the Oval and seeing Michael Holding and, you know, kind of thinking, oh, I fancy that. But when he was really quite relatively old, you hear about kids taking up the game when they were 5 or 6, but he was 12, which is relatively late, really. And I think that one of the things he obviously wants to do with Gloucestershire is make it even more of a community club, which draws in people from all sides or walks of society. And in a way, you know, Bristol particularly, it's very much a polyglot, isn't it? It's a real interesting mixture of all sorts of cultures. And Gloucestershire could really be that focal point for all those types. And I think that's what Sid is seeking to do, which is a brilliant idea, a brilliant initiative.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I have perhaps felt with Gloucestershire is, I mean, I don't live in Bristol anymore, but I did. And just from a distance, is sort of how bound up in the community is. I'm sure it would say it is very bound up in the community, but sometimes it feels like it's sort of tucked away off the Gloucester Road in Bishopston behind sort of loads of houses. And you might know it's there now because they've put the floodlights up and you can see it from a distance. But before, it was a fairly sort of, it was sort of tucked away sort of ground, not sort of really part of the city. You know, you could almost live in the area and not know the ground is there. It's slightly different now with the floodlights up. So it would be great to see that change and sort of Gloucestershire to become really sort of part of the community in Bristol and really draw people in, yeah, and be a sort of focal point.
If you think of what's happened, say, I think they should look at it as what's happened at, say, Somerset or Essex, where, you know, those two grounds also right in the centre of the town. And I think it should be an advantage to Gloucestershire that Bristol, the ground, is so much in the heart of that. You know, there's quite a few sort of back-to-back houses around the ground itself. It's a very congested area. Mm. They should be drawing all those people to the ground. There's thousands of people within a mile of the ground. There'd be a huge population of very diverse people. That you know, that ground could be easily the focal point for all those people.
Yeah, it's not in those of people who don't know the county ground in Bristol, it's not right, it's not in the centre, not by any means. It's sort of out of the centre a bit, sort of 2.5 miles up Gloucester Road out of the centre, and it's sort of tucked away on a down Neville Road about sort of 300, 400 metres.
No, it's actually a nightmare to get to, isn't it? I can never find it when I'm trying to drive there.
Well, there we are.
Down the wrong road.
Yeah, well, there we are. You know, I mean, obviously people live in Bristol. Everyone's got sat navs these days, haven't they? And phones and stuff which tell them where to go.
But there's always one-way systems and, you know, no entries and all sorts, you know. So it's very congested around there. If they could kind of create a more obvious... Well, it's hard to create a new access point. And in actual fact, there is a good access point behind the hotel there. But... I don't know. I think there's so much potential, personally.
Yeah, you would think so, wouldn't you? It's a big city. I mean, some people say, you know, we need fewer counties. You know, we've got 18 and we still cut it to 14. And so, well, who are going to be the counties to go? And, you know, Gloucestershire in recent years, their crowds have not been that good particularly. But it's in a big city. It really is. I mean, I think it's the seventh biggest city in the country. You feel it should be, you know, more. I mean, they've never won the county championship, for example. I mean, you feel it should be more successful than it is. It has had some great name players associated with it, you know, right back to WG, of course, Wally Hammond, and there was Proctorshire in the 70s, and they came very close to winning
Courtney
the title.
Walsh is my favourite. I mean, Woof, yeah. What an incredible cricketer he was. And he, of course, partnered with Sid for many years, opening the bowling. They were a horrible pair of bowlers to face. I was unfortunate enough to be night watchman a couple of times, and you know, both of them basically tried to kill me. Luckily, they never got anywhere near hitting me or getting my stumps, so I survived. But Courtney Walsh, 1,800 first-class wickets, 17 years as a first-class cricketer. They called him Duracell because he just kept going. And he was the loveliest guy off the field. And then he had that ability with the ball to bowl the odd sort of... I remember facing him the first time, actually, and watching him from the stand, from the pavilion at the back there, thinking, he doesn't look that quick. And I got out there, and the first two balls I faced from Courtney Walsh, I blocked, easy. I thought, well, this is easy. This is what's all the fuss about? The third one, short of a length, came from nowhere and just went straight for my neck. And I sort of put my, you know, fended my hands up in the air and palmed a catch to short leg. And I thought, oh, yeah, OK. Yeah, he has got something, actually. I don't know where that came from, but it was quick and horrible to face and got me out.
Well, that Sid and Courtney nearly won Gloucestershire the championship in 1986. They actually had a 52-point lead in August. Can you imagine that? A 52-point lead in August, early August, and they didn't win the title. They lost a match at Essex. And Essex were their main rivals. Essex had some games in hand, and they leapfrogged them and won the title by about 25 points. So that, you know, that was another point where you thought they might win the title with Sid and Courtney roaring in for them. And then, of course, they had that great one-day period of success. But in the Championship, it's been a bit thin. They are back in the First Division, but they've not had a great start to the season. They're, you know, down towards the bottom with Somerset at the moment, so there's definite room for improvement. But I think Sid was making the point, wasn't it? It's not, you know, his role is not going to be about what goes on the field. It's about what goes on in the community off the field. Those that trying to engage, I think, with the community. Well,
and that should lead to better cricketers, you know, or more cricketers joining the club, and hopefully some of them will become very good. And I love the underdog. You know, I love the fact that, for instance, the Rajasthan Royals won the first IPL back in 2008, who were the least fancied team, captained, of course, by Shane Warne. And incidentally, just as an aside, tomorrow at the Rajasthan Royals game in the IPL, they're doing a special commemorative day in memory of Shane Warne. They're putting up some banners and stuff, and some of the Warne family are travelling out to the match. He's being dubbed the first Royal, because, of course, he was captain in that first season. So that's quite a nice touch from the Rajasthan Royals. But I just think, and actually, of course, in fact, Warne, he played in Bristol, didn't he? Before he played Test cricket.
He did, yeah. He played in...
He was a bit of a lager lout, I think, more than anything. Yeah, but he certainly, you know, did his grounding in English club cricket in Bristol.
Yeah, indeed he did. He played for Downend, which is a suburb about six, seven miles from the centre of Bristol. Small ground with a churchyard quite near it. I dare say he probably hit a few in there. He might well have been, as a 18, 19-year-old, might have been hit in there a few times. Yeah, he did.
Marcus Truskovic started in the Bristol area as well.
Keynsham, yeah.
He got lost to Somerset. So you missed one there, didn't you?
Well, Bristol's a strange cricketing city, really, because people say that if you live in North Bristol, you support Gloucestershire. If you live in South Bristol, you support Somerset. Or if you're south of the river, you support Somerset. So there are parts of Bristol that are Somerset enclaves. And actually, Somerset, in the old days, in the John Player League days, Somerset used to play home matches in Bristol, which is a bit, you know, it's a bit strange, isn't it, really? Cricket, perhaps not quite as tribal as football is. But, yeah, that's the way of it. So, yeah, in Bristol, if you live in the south, you support Somerset and Bristol City. If you live in the north of Bristol, you're supposed to support Gloucestershire and Bristol Rovers. But that didn't happen with me. Yeah.
And actually, Sid is a Bristol Rovers fan, isn't he?
Is, yeah.
So you and he should have gone hammer and tongs at each other the other night.
Well, we quickly moved on. I mean, Sid and I used to work, we worked on BBC Radio a lot around about the time of Gloucestershire being successful, around about the turn of the century, because we did a lot of commentaries on Gloucestershire matches on the BBC. And he was our regular summariser, and normally it was victory. It's incredible to think, actually, in 2000, Gloucestershire won all three one-day trophies. It was a remarkable side, a side of no sort of real obvious stars. Eddie and Harvey was a very good one-day cricketer. I mean, no sort of what you call no great players, but everyone knew their role.
Jack Russell, of course. That.
Mike Smith, John Lewis,
Jones, Snape. But they had a formula, didn't they? Mm. They created a formula which was lots of nagging medium paces with Jack Russell stood up to the stumps on what you might call a... I was going to call it a shit heap at Bristol. I mean, perhaps that's a bit harsh, but it wasn't a great pitch. It zipped and zapped around, and they worked out a brilliant way of playing there. It was very effective. Jack Russell was brilliant, wasn't he? I mean, Jack Russell, behind the stumps, standing up, you could never relax. He was so good.
Well, they didn't just win matches at Bristol, Yoz. Of course, they won matches at Lords because they won some finals. So it wasn't just about winning the games in Bristol.
Touché.
Anyway, I think it's time to go. Good luck to Sid in what he's trying to do off the field at Gloucestershire. Good luck to Rob Key as well. How long does the honeymoon period last for? I don't know how long do honeymoon periods last for? Normally about a couple of weeks, don't they? But anyway, we'll see.
About as long as marriages.
Rob,
except in your case.
It's
been good talking about the county game, and we'll do more of that as the season wears on. Just to tip you off, though, actually, in the next podcast will be about village cricket, because our special guest early next week is the historian James Holland, who's just created an amazing victory for his club team in the Chalk Valley. So we're going to explore village cricket and also cricket in the Second World War. That's the next podcast coming up in a couple of days' time. But in the meantime, hope you've enjoyed this one, and thanks for listening.
Goodbye for now.
Podcast Network.